Welcome to the third edition of Rock Tales, produced by Podicle. Following the huge success and complete self-indulgence of Rock Tales 1 and 2, we once again gathered together a small illustrious group of hugely talented musicians, producers and music industry veterans to share their favourite backstage stories and other tales. This month our guests are record producer and composer Simon Boswell, record plugger and music publisher Steve Payne, TV and radio producer Nick Carpenter, record producer and songwriter Pete Woodruff, record producer and songwriter Nikki Graham, and this month's hosts Podicle's very own David Beeching and John Mays. Situated in the upstairs lounge at the Hope Pub in London's West End, we turned on the microphones and let it roll unscripted from there. But be warned, this pubcast contains some very strong language, the occasional and annoying sound of drilling in the next door building, the rustle of dry roast peanut packets, and the scraping of chairs as our guests played musical chairs. We're not too sure that Nikki came particularly well prepared.
I'm going to have to take trousers off.
Trousers?
Sorry, coat.
Back in the day, that's what you would have done.
In this pub.
You've got the wrong idea about this.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Rock Tales 3. I think the best thing to do is to go around the table. I shall start to my right.
Hello, I'm Nick Carpenter. I've worked in and around the music industry in live TV and broadcasts and events for many years as a stage manager and a floor manager. And I've witnessed a variety of weird and wonderful things.
I'm Pete Woodruff. I started off making tea for Bucks Fizz and working with Andy Hill, their producer, who's great. And I then went to be a recording engineer, eventually being a producer for Def Leppard. Then after 12 years of that, had kids and studied songwriting. So I've been writing since then. But I haven't really met anyone. I'm always in a room with darkened room with a microphone saying no.
You've got a very good studio talent.
Very good studio turn.
Hi, I'm Simon Boswell. I guess I've never ever done what my mother would have called a proper job. I got signed up when I was 18 as a finger-picking acoustic guitarist on Transatlantic Records when I'm in my first term at university, actually. So it's very strange for me. So I've only ever made music, been in bands, been a record producer, and then finally a film composer for the last 30 years. So it's kind of varied, but all music related.
Well, we can't wait to hear your stories. The juicier, the better. And next we have Mr. Stevie Payne.
Yeah, I came in the music business when I was about 17, working for Charisma Records in Soho Square as the office boy. Progressed to Atlantic Records, doing London promotion with Led Zeppelin, the Stones, you name it, they were there. Then I went on to other companies, ended up at Polydor Records, then went independent and left the business actually about 15 years ago, but still kept in contact with everyone and I dabble nowadays. That's about what I do.
Dabble.
Yeah.
That's a good word.
Dabble.
Mr. Nicky Graham, welcome.
Thank you very much. I don't know how long you've got because I'm 74 and my track record and history goes back a long way, so I'll try and keep it short and sweet. First and foremost, I was a musician playing in a band, and the band was signed by Bill Wyman from the Stones and then signed on to one of the labels that are all capital in America, and I played with that band. They were called The End, first of all, and then Tucky Buzzard, strange names. Shall I stop now?
Tucky Buzzard.
Turkey.
Oh, Turkey
Buzzard. No, Tucky Buzzard.
Tucky, oh, okay. Yeah.
It was Tucky because it was Brer Rabbit and Brer Fox and Brer Tucky Buzzard, which was actually a turkey buzzard, but they lost the R somewhere. So, the funny thing is I'm sitting in this pub and it brings to mind a story. During the 70s, the Musicians Union would not allow Top of the Pops to use backing tracks. So everybody worked out this wonderful system where they could pretend to record a backing track, in other words, record the whole record again, in the studio next door, which was Whitfield Street Studios. The guy from the union would turn up at the studio and we'd say, oh, we're all set up, you know, ready to do the re-record. And we'd say, why don't you go down the pub? So we sent him to this pub, to the Hope, which is 50 yards from the entrance to Whitfield Street.
In the hope that he wouldn't come back.
Well, he did always come back, but he came back well plastered because Judd would have been taking him in there, or one of the promotion guys, and consequently, he was quite plastered by the time he got back, and we'd hand him the fully re-recorded, not backing track of something that it took somebody years to make, and we'd done it in 5 minutes, and he'd go away happy, and then the backing track of the original record would be on Top of the Pops, so everyone's was happy. One occasion, we were waiting, all set up, ready to pretend this record, and the union guy came in, and somebody followed him up the stairs and came in and walked straight into the studio, and the union guy walked into the control room, and this guy walked into the studio, and he picked up a tambourine, and he started playing the tambourine. And I said to the union guy, I don't really think this is a good idea to have your friend playing the tambourine on this record. And he said, that's not my friend. He just got in the lift with me and he came off. He was on the street outside and he followed me in.
Was the union guy called Dr. Death? Was that his nickname?
It was.
Dr. Death, that's right.
Yeah. So this pub has some fond memories for me.
On that note, can I just tell you a quick story about Judd again?
Yeah.
When I was at Charisma as the office boy, I'd literally been there about 6 months, and Clifford T. Ward had a hit called Gay, if you remember that song. And it was a massive, massive hit. The phone rang on Judd's desk, and I was in the office on my own at lunchtime. They're all up the pub getting pissed, whatever. I picked the phone up, and there's this guy called Robin Nash, who you'll know.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, yeah, this is Judd's phone. He said, this is Robin Nash, and I had no idea who this guy was. No idea at all. He said, I need to know the lineup of the track for Gay. Can you tell me what it is? And I said, I've no idea, but I would look for you now. And he said, I need to know now exactly what Robin would be like. So I got they got the album, and I looked on the back sleeve, and it had drums, bass, guitar, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. And I told him all this. And it never got on Top of the Pops that week because Robin went mental at Judd because, you know, why did that idiot tell me it had the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra? Why couldn't it say it had a string quartet on it? Because obviously, 60, 70, 80 people.
90.
No money to give for that. Yeah. So that was my little story about him and Dr. Death.
To finish on my history, because I never got very far, I got as far as the...
Tucky Buzzard.
Tucky Buzzard. I then quit the band and... Oh, God, what did I do? I became an A&R man, which is, as we all know, it's an arm and arm man. And I worked, first of all, for Polydor, and then I worked for CBS, which was around the corner here, initially in Theobald's Road and then in Soho Square, which is where I met you, Dave. Dave's here. He's my old mate on my right. So I ummed and ahed for a number of years, and in that process managed to produce quite a few records, none of which were, well, I suppose you could call the Nolans, they were big. We used to call them 20 giant tits. No, it was 20 giant hits, that's right. Because they were signed to Warner's and they did an album called 20 giant hits. So they were known in the business. And they were actually 20 giant hits. But there were only five of them. I've got another story about it. I won't tell you. These are not rock tales at all.
It's fine.
These are pop tales. Anyway, I worked at CBS as a house producer for a number of years, and then in 84 I left to be an independent because I'd been working with Bonnie Tyler, and I was only doing demos with her, which we did next door. And Muff then said, thank you, Nicky, really wonderful demos, but we're going to get Jim Steinman to produce. And I thought, there's another one of these, I'll be passed over forever, I'll be passed over. So I left and I walked out of the office and found Bros and put them together with their manager, Tom Watkins, and wrote and produced two, three albums with lots of success. And that went on to a lot more productions, but that's for part two.
Fantastic.
Well done.
Brilliant.
Thank you, Nicky.
Well done. As I've been name checked, sitting next to you, so nice to see you. My name's David Beechey. We worked together at CBS in the days. I was just a humble plugger in those days, and you were a senior A&R man, dare
senior,
I say.
Yes, yeah. I was. And still senior.
We had to knock on his door.
So, yes, a plugger, and I've got some stories, I hope, and we'll come to those later. Passing you over to my next pal who's sitting
well,
next to
me. Hang on, Dave. I need to thank you publicly because at one point I had a phone call from South Africa where my father was saying that my father had died. And I was absolutely mortified. And who walked in my office but Dave? And I told him that my father had died, and you consoled me, and you were a great support. So thank you publicly for that. Needless to state, CBS offered me a flight to go in to the funeral, and I thought, oh, they're going to charge me. It's going to appear on the reduction of my expenses. So I didn't actually go. What was the point of going 6,000 miles to see my father who had died?
I apologise for Mr. Blacknell not being here today. His cat is not well, and we should let our listeners know he treats his cats as if they were his children. So, unfortunately, our great leader and the man who first put these things together isn't here to guide us, but let's have awkward and embarrassing moments. Kick us off, Steve.
Okay. It goes back to the day when I was at EMI Records, and we had the Division Bell album by Pink Floyd coming out, and I was tasked with going to Montreal to do some interviews for Floyd with Johnny Walker and Nicky Horn from Capital Radio. Johnny from Radio 1, of course. So we went to Montreal, got there for the first night, the Sunday night for the shows. Walker and I decided that it'd be a good idea to go and have a drink and something to eat before we went to the show at 8 o'clock that night. So we duly did that. So we got to the gig at about 8 o'clock. As we walked into the gig, took our seats, Dave Gilmour said, "Thank you, good night." Me and Walker looked at him and thought, what the hell have we done here? Luckily, though, I have to say we were there for two nights and saw the second night. But we went backstage to see the band after the show that night, and they said, what do you think of the show then, boys? With a knowing look in their eye, we thought, well, hang on, something's up here. And we went backstage, yeah, and Johnny went, yeah, it was fantastic. I said, oh, brilliant. I just, blah, blah, bullshit. They went, well, funny enough, we saw you on the cameras coming in just before we finished, because it was cameras everywhere all on the show. So we suffered badly on that one. But we managed to do the next show, and we also went on the plane back to Toronto with them. So it was all good in the end, but very embarrassing gig, very. But it never got reported back to my bosses at EMI.
Now, I remember being at a Christa Berg gig,
right?
Because I worked at Rondo Music and we had his publishing. And he was an interesting character, and he was managed by Kenny Thompson. One of his brothers played with Supertramp, played bass.
Yeah.
And his other brother, Ali Thompson, was a songwriter. But
I'm just back in touch with, by the way.
Are you?
Just got in touch with him.
Has he just cropped up on Facebook for you as well?
And in America, songwriting in America. But anyway, sorry.
But my wife and I had been to so many of Christa Berg's gigs on the tour, we just thought, oh, let's go and have some dinner. And of course, I'd forgotten how diligent Kenny Thompson was in terms of the merch. That was the big thing, you know, how many Christa Berg t-shirts. So we watched the first number, sneaked out, went through the foyer, and there's Kenny standing behind the t-shirt counter going, yes, and where are you going? Nightmare. So dinner was off that night. That was a very tiny, embarrassing moment, really. He forgave me afterwards.
Do you want an embarrassing moment?
Yeah, go on.
At one stage, I had a studio, well, I still do have a studio in Parsons Green, but it was at number 25. And if you know Parsons Green, Heathman's Road, opposite the Sloney Pony, is a cul-de-sac. Once you're down there, you have to drive reverse out, or you're stuck down there. And my studio was at number 25, which is the very end of Parsons Green, of Heathman's Road, and on the third floor. And at one point, I was producing these two kids from Newcastle called Ant and Deck. And they were then known as PJ and Duncan. They used to come down from Newcastle and we'd record them, and then they'd go back in the same day. I had decided I wanted a sofa from my house to be put in the studio. The only way to get it in there was to pull it on a rope from the ground floor up to the third floor entrance, which was one of those, like a doorway on the side of a building with a beam at the top, that you could put a rope round and you could pull in old-fashioned, you know, bales of hay or, you know. And so we attached a rope to this thing, lowered it down, and attached it to the sofa, which I'd had delivered onto the ground floor. And I said to Anton Deck, will you please just make sure it doesn't swing in the wind or anything like that? So we were up the top pulling away, and this sofa gradually worked its way from ground floor to the first floor. And about the second floor, it was swinging a bit. Ant and Deck were down at the bottom looking up at this thing, and suddenly the rope snapped. And this sofa went thrash to the ground. Fortunately, they stepped aside. If they hadn't stepped aside,
we'd have been spared a lot.
The rest would not have been history.
The best embarrassment of it.
Now, who round the table thinks that's a shame?
Exactly.
Well, I don't feel it's a shame because they've kept me in considerable amount of royalties for the years, because I wrote Let's Get Ready to Rumble, and that was a hit quite recently again, and the royalties keep coming in. I should have bought this drink, actually, Dave.
It must be really nice, a piece like that that just keeps on giving.
Well, the Bros stuff keeps on giving, and the more they do these ridiculous documentaries, the better it is for me.
I thought you planned that.
No, I didn't even know they were doing it. And as soon as I saw that they were going to be doing this, I thought, ka-ching. But that's, you know, the joy of the PRS and collecting royalties.
The only embarrassing thing I can think of, not necessarily embarrassing for me, but embarrassing for the two people concerned. I was working on, do you remember they did those gigs at Buckingham Palace for the Queen's Jubilee or whatever it was? And they did two. I did both of them. I think it was the Golden Jubilee and the Diamond Jubilee. So it was back in the, 2002, I think. And the two people that were on the bill, or two of the people that were on this sort of massive multi-artist bill, were Ozzy Osbourne and Brian Wilson. Not the sort of people you would expect to be in each other's company. And it turned out that Ozzy was a massive, you wouldn't have believed this, but Ozzy was a massive Beach Boys fan and was completely starstruck by Brian Wilson. And we were just chatting to Ozzy, and he said, oh, look, there's Brian Wilson over there. I'm so excited. I can't believe it. It's Brian Wilson. Look, Sharon, look, it's Brian Wilson. Oh, my God, look. I've got to go and talk to him. And so he said, can I go and talk to him? I said, well, of course you can. I'm not stopping you. Just go and say hi. So you know what Ozzy's like. He sort of stumbled over. And then Brian Wilson, bless him, is a bit like a Thunderbirds puppet himself. So the two of them were kind of wobbling in front of each other. Brian Wilson was on another planet. Ozzy goes, oh, Brian, it's great to meet you. And Brian just stared at him and didn't really say anything and then just wandered off completely vacantly and left Ozzy standing there. And Ozzy turned around to us and said, oh, what a fucking weirdo! So awkward for Ozzy, but...
Pete?
I can't think of anything particularly embarrassing.
There must be loads of embarrassing moments.
Having got the gig to engineer for Def Leppard when Mike Shipley was producing them, and we went to Mutt Lange's house, and Mutt Lange was a legend, and it was like, oh my God, I'm meeting this guy and he's made these amazing records, and don't put your foot in it. And I have a kind of joke Tourette's. Have I told you this? I don't know. Anyway, I have this Tourette's where I always make a bad joke and it's often at the wrong time. So the band are discussing with Mutt about the album and saying, you know, we decided to build home studios and put our own gear in. And that way we won't spend $3 million on the album, which the previous one had cost because they'd been in this Lord for 3 years. And so, you know, it's going to be much cheaper. And Mutt said, recording, I think, can be much, much cheaper now, but mixing's always going to be expensive. And I went, not the way I do it. I never worked with them again.
Is that true? You never worked
That's
with
good.
Them?
No,
I didn't. That's what I thought.
I never mixed for him, though, strangely.
You're looking at me. You're looking at me. This is going to take a little bit of explaining, really, in terms of the different things I've done in my career. But there was a point at which I was producing records in Rome, in Italy. I got sort of stuck into producing Italian pop stars and singer-songwriters. As a consequence of which, I was asked to write music for a movie, which has began this whole other period in my career for the last 30 years, being a film composer. And this was entirely by accident and not by design, because I didn't know anything about film music, film composing, or... well, just nothing to do with it, really. However, I got sucked into this sort of mid-80s scene in Italy of writing the music for exploitation movies. You know, it's a sort of spaghetti industry, especially horror films. And the first horror film I ever did was with a director called Dario Argento, who's gone on to become this sort of godfather of horror all over the world. Anyway, I had this career going on in Italy. And the first 5 years, I only did Italian films. I did over 20 movies in 5 years before anyone in the rest of the world knew about it. I thought it was my little secret that no one would ever hear about. But anyway, this is a long way around to this embarrassing story. We flip forward to 1999, and there's a friend of mine who kind of guided me through the producing stuff in Italy. He's Italian, he lives in Rome, and worked for RCA Records then, and who then got me into doing film soundtracks. In 1999, I got a phone call asking me if I was interested in making an album with the Pope. And, you know, I am a very long way from being any kind of saint, religious, not in the slightest, let alone Catholic. And I actually had to turn down this first offer, which was to work with John Paul II, Pope John Paul II, on this album. And my friend had this idea, seeing him on his balcony, is it Easter? I don't even know that much, where you know, he talks to the crowd and sings a Gregorian chant, which is part of the Catholic Mass. I had no idea about any of it. Anyway, he had an idea that it would be great, wouldn't it, to take the Pope's speeches and the Pope singing and put them to music. So he asked if I would do this album. I had to say no, because I was really busy doing, I had loads of movies to do, and I said no, and I didn't do it, and I didn't do this first album, which came out on Sony Classical in America, sold 2 or 3 million, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I didn't do it. A few years after that, he said, there's another project with John Paul, which we'd like you to do. We made a video, and they had made a video with Italy's top pop promo maker, which looks like an ecstasy-fueled rave video. You know, it's got, literally got John Paul II walking across pink clouds, and you know, it's just, it's banger, completely banger. Mental. Anyway, so...
A difficult second album.
Exactly. Anyway, so I was asked, would I, you know, they needed music for it all, in all kinds of different things. So, and could I have a meeting? They were going to have a meeting in St. Peter's Square. And I know you can't really make this up, but the Vatican has a media company called St. Paul Multimedia. okay, and they have offices in St. Peter's Square. And there you have the trendy priests who wear jeans, and, you know. And I went to this meeting, and I was actually had arranged that I would have a holiday outside Rome, same time with my family. So I went to the meeting in shorts and sandals, and I took my laptop with me in a rucksack and went into these offices. As I walked in ahead, I could see there was a poster of Jaws on the wall, and then next to it there was a poster of the Virgin Mary, and then there was like a Clint Eastwood film poster. Anyway, it's just a completely crazy situation. So I go into this office, there are three trendy priests sitting behind a table, and in the interim of all this happening, John Paul II has died, but they've decided they want to make the film into a project called Santo Subito, to make him a saint, meaning make him a saint quick, Santo Subito, which is what lots of the crowd were holding up. And they asked me if I would write music for his funeral, for fuck's sake.
Wow.
Right, so, you know, this is like completely, I still have no explanation for what their interest in me was, except that it was my friend who I knew through pop and rock days and all that. So I go into this meeting, they want to show me footage of the funeral to get my idea. These three trendy priests are trying to make their DVD player work, and they can't. So I have my laptop with me, right, and I say, oh, don't worry about it, I've got my laptop. So I'm rummaging around, and I'm there on holiday, and I pull my laptop out, I'm trying to find a power supply. Onto the floor falls a copy of the Da Vinci Code, which I'm reading on holiday, and I put my foot on it. Right, because there's something on the table, they couldn't quite. So I had to sit for an hour and a half in St. Peter's Square with this book burning a hole through my sandals. Right, whilst they showed me the footage on my laptop.
That's
Father
Ted, isn't it?
It is Father Ted. I later discovered, by the way, well, I just finished this story slightly, that they knew that I had just been working with Elton John, which is another story I could tell, on a movie soundtrack. And these priests said to me, they said, we hear you've been working with Elton, and we were wondering whether he might like to write a song for the end titles. And I said, really? You really sure? You Elton John? And they went, yes, we'd love that too. And I said, you do understand, don't you, And they said, no, what? And I said, he's homosessuale. He's homosexual. No. All these people, no. All of them. It was just like the most absurd situation. Which, and then there I am with my foot on the Da Vinci Code. So he happened to tell them Elton John was gay, you know, in the middle of the situation. It's totally crazy. But it gets even more insane as time goes on with this whole project. But perhaps I should draw a line under that.
Did
it's
you
pretty
do
embarrassing.
It? Did you do it?
I did do it.
You did it.
Oh, I did do it.
The first one won a Grammy.
Yes, it did. It did.
First story.
Yeah. yeah. I turned that one down. Well, there's a later album I did with the next Pope. I can carry on with this if you want me to. After this John Paul II thing came out, which confused the world a lot. Because I did. They gave me, you know, this whole film with his speeches on it and a bit of him singing. Oh, okay, I've got to tell you this bit of it. Okay, so the bit of him singing this Gregorian chant, okay, I'm supposed to put it to music. And he can't sing really at all. And so he's kind of singing, you know, he's in between semitones, shall we say. So I'm writing some chords around what he's doing. And I'm going, well, I'm going to have to auto-tune him. So I'm thinking that note, you know, that would really fit this chord sequence if it was... if I take it up just a bit, right, and this note, take it down. And I write this thing and I send it off to them. And I get this phone call back saying, Simon, we love what you've done, but I'm afraid you can't change the Catholic Mass. I had changed the tune. There's an American documentary maker who's done a thing on me recently, which is called You Can't Auto-Tune the Pope, which is a nice title. But anyway, it went on for me working with the Nazi paedophile Pope, Pope Benedict, after that, on an album for Geffen Records, which is just another insane, surreal thing, but I'll maybe... come back to that one later.
Are you doing Prince Andrew's new album?
Listen, don't joke about anything. I've talked to the priests about doing an album in the wake of it. Everyone now thought I'm some kind of like religious, you know, expert, guru.
Now that's what I call religion.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. Exactly. Well, we had a whole Top of the Popes thing on Sky News and everything when we did this other album, which was just with this Geffen album.
I assume you speak fluent Italian.
I speak pretty good Italian after working it since the mid-80s, early 80s as a producer. Yeah.
So could you go to the Vatican as a tax exile, having done this?
I'd like to think so. I mean,
Did you get your book back in the bag safely? Could it go in?
Did I get what?
Your book, did it go in your bag?
I did go back in my bag safely. And I later discovered when we were working at Westminster Cathedral in London, they were going to put on this whole Pope Benedict thing, which is sort of a few years after all this. I was conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in Westminster Cathedral, and they filmed the whole thing, and they made a documentary about it all. And I remember the director, who was English, asking the priest in charge of all the theological content, why had they asked me to write music? And this priest falling over laughing in the bookshop there and saying, well, Jesus loves a sinner. Mm. Which I happen to have on my headstone. But I then discovered in this bookshop, they sell the fucking Da Vinci Code.
Really?
In their bookshop. It's, for as far as they're concerned, it's all great publicity. They don't care. They don't care. So I needn't have bothered.
Follow that.
I'm off. Good stuff. I was working for Andrew Lloyd Webber on Love. Love Changes Everything, the Michael Ball single, and the whole setup. What was the name of it come from the
Aspects
of Love. I was working on that with Michael, and I was really close with Michael for many, many months, and working with Andrew really closely as well. Does anyone know Andrew here? You might have met him. He's actually a fantastic bloke. He's incredibly funny. Oh, you're right, he does. That's the bloke, yeah. But he's good. He's good fun. In fact, I said to him once, did you buy all your prints at his house in Eton Square? I said, did you buy your prints from Athena? And of course, they're Rembrandts and they're like, whatever. But he thought that was quite funny. But anyway, cut long story. It was his 50th birthday and he had a party at Annabelle's in Berkeley Square. And the good and the great were invited, and he invited me, which was fantastic. So I met up with Michael.
Were you good or great?
I don't know what I was, but at the end of the night, I'll tell you what happened. I turned up at the party around about 8 o'clock. You were supposed to be there for like 8:05 at the latest, otherwise it was like the doors were shut, you don't get in. I walked in the door, and a big guy came up to me and said, "Stop," he said, "who are you?" I said, "My name's Steve Payne." He went, "Oh, head of promotion, Polydor Records." And I went, "That's weird, why would he know that without even looking at something?" And I thought, gosh, really, like, took me back a bit. So anyway, so I walked through, and I sort of said hello to people, and Andrew's at the end table, and he said, Steve. So when he calls, you go. So I went up to the table, and I'm sitting there, and he said, "Do you know everybody on the table?" And I said, "Well," I looked along the table, and "Yeah, I know most people." Said Sarah was there, Sarah Brightman, who I just worked with as well, and Andrew, of course. And he said, "Do you know this chap next to me?" And I looked at him, and I said, and I sort of doffed my cap if I'd had one on, and I went, "Yes, of course I know who you are, sir. Yeah." He said, "Who do you know me by?" This is this guy, and I said, "Oh, you're Prince Edward, of course, sir." And he went, "No, I'm the fucking useless cunt." And I went, "Pardon?" I said, "I'm sorry." He said, "At the time, Edward worked for Andrew Lloyd Webber. And I used to call this guy up to get stuff done. And he always fucked up." And I said, "You're such a useless cunt. Why can't you get this right? I know, I'm the one who's going to get in the neck from Andrew if you don't do it right." And he went, and I remember his voice. And when I saw him, I thought, 2 and 2. Yes, it's the same guy. It's the same man. And the kind of said, it was all right at the end. It was great. It was all right. I sat and chatted to him. But it was like, you know, that was an embarrassment. Because the whole table just went like that. Because obviously, I didn't know who he was. It was Andrew. That's all I knew. Edward, I mean, that's all I knew him was. No, I'm going to use this fucking cunt, Edward.
Well, sorry.
But there you go. Yeah, that was quite embarrassing, I think. If you can put that on the table,
no, feel free. I like that.
It's a true story.
I wasn't going to mention this, but as we had the Pope and now Prince Edward, this isn't strictly rock and roll, but it is royal. I was working on do you remember a few years ago they used to do on ITV the military awards, basically giving awards to soldiers for doing their job. But we did it from the Imperial War Museum. And the guest of honour one show was Prince Charles and Camilla. They were the guests at the end, and they were going to present the sort of big award at the end. And you know the way those award shows work. You rehearse all day with the various acts and presenters and artists. But the royals being the royals, they come at the last minute. So you don't get a chance to rehearse with them or tell them what to do or give them any direction, because they come in, everyone stands up, they sit down to dinner, then the show starts, and boom, you know, they have to go on. So halfway through the dinner, the director decides, because the royals were sitting at the top table in front of the stage, he said, "You know what, I think it'd be really nice if Charles goes up one way, Camilla goes up the other, and they greet each other at the stairs, shake hands, and then walk up the stairs together. It would, on camera, that's going to look really nice. Somebody needs to go and tell them." So I was elected to go and tell them. So you know what it's like with those TV shows. You have to literally sort of wait until you're out of shot and crawl along the floor and stuff. So I'm sort of trying to make sure I'm not seen as I crawl on all fours under the table to try and tell Prince Charles that he has to do this. So Charles is sitting on the left, Camilla's sitting on the right, and in between them was David and Samantha Cameron, because Cameron was Prime Minister at the time. So I pop up between the Prime Minister and Prince Charles and say, "Oh, excuse me, you know, when you come on, would you mind like going one side? Maybe you could greet the Duchess and, you know, go up on." And he got it immediately. He's quite media savvy. He said, yeah, no problem. Perhaps you could tell my wife," he said. So I crawl round and I tap her on the leg. And she is just, I think she was half caught on gin or something, and she just goes, What are you saying to me? What are you saying to me? I don't understand. What are you saying to me?" I said, "Well, maybe if you could, you know, the prince is going to go one side, if you could go the other and up the stairs to go." "I don't understand. What do I? And I'm literally on the floor in between her and the Prime Minister. I catch David Cameron's eye, and we both kind of roll our eyes. It was a really bizarre moment. I could see all the rest of the crew over the other side of the floor, like, laughing at me. And I'm stuck there. I can't move because it's, you know, we're in the middle of a shot. So I'm hiding under the table. And this was going on, and she hadn't a clue what I was trying to say. And in the end, Prince Charles leant across and said, "Oh, for God's sake, woman, just follow me up onto the stage." So, yeah, that was awkward all around. Not rock and roll, but it is the royals. There you go.
I've got there's a thing which I'm not very proud of, but it's like when I tell people, they go, "I'm leaving now." I've actually been with three rock stars the night they died. And it was, you're leaving. But it's, I was out with Gary Holton, who was in Heavy Metal Kids, and also in Alfie Saint Petnor, a great actor, fabulous bloke, great guy. I was out with him drinking, and went home the next night. Next day, picked the paper up, and he was dead, which is like, fucking hell, what happened there? Well, we all know what happened. Paul Kossoff from Free, he was in a band called Backstreet Crawler, and he was about to fly off to America with the Backstreet Crawler to tour New York and those areas and go up to LA. And we went to Hampstead with Dave D of Dave D, Dozy, Beatty, Mick and Titch, of course, who was head of A&R at Atlantic Records at the time. And we went to a parlour, should we say, in Hampstead. And Paul had just come out of hospital that day from massive heart problems he had and his heroin addiction. They'd sorted him out. And he got on the plane that night and didn't wake up in New York. And the other one was the saddest one of all, was a great mate of mine, was Bon Scott from AC/DC, because I worked with them at Atlantic Records when they first came over, which is another plug-in story actually, which is a good one. And well, I say it's good, you might think it's not good, but it was, I think. And was out drinking with him in Maid of Ale, again with Gary Holton, was in Maid of Ale as well. And I said to Bon, it's time to go, I'm going to go, what are you doing? He said, I'll stick around for a little while. So I went and again got home the next day, bang, he's gone as well.
I'm not having a drink with you later.
No, so I don't go out after six anymore, but it's going to be bad. No, it was awful, because it was just like, you know, they were such close people. I said they were close. I was close with Bon, very close with Bon and Gary, but Paul was like just someone that was a hero of mine from the Free days, and he signed to Atlantic Records, a band called Backstreet Caller. They were just embarking on their career and they were like actually doing great stuff. Bad times. But AC/DC is just the plug-in story. When they first came to this country, they flew in, and I met them at the airport for their first ever interviews. And when they came, I met them at the airport. I'd been to Radio 1 3 days before with It's a Long Way to Rock and Roll. If there's a long way to the top, if you want to rock and roll. And I took a video machine in a suit, in a briefcase, I should say. And I showed Radio 1 for the first time this video. Never had it done before. It was Ron Belshave, the guy you were talking about earlier on. And he loved it. And he started playing it. And the next day I had to go to the airport to meet them. We went to Radio Luxembourg with a lovely guy called Ken Evans, if anyone remembers Ken Evans. The lovely Ken. And had a chat, did an interview with them. Then we went to a pub in Mayfair. I can't remember the name of it. And it was a Friday night, 8 o'clock, and they started kicking off. And I said, what are you doing? And they were picking up, and they were hitting people, fighting. This was AC/DC, so they'd just come in the country. And I said, what are you doing this for? He said, it's Friday night, mate, this is what we do. And I said, yeah, not here. Anyway, the police were called, but we got out before they came. But they were like, again, great boys to work with, great boys. But Bond died, bless him, he died.
But Def Leppard, well behaved.
Yeah.
I'm sure they probably were.
Yeah, they're pretty well behaved, they were. They once were on tour, and they're these two groupies who were trying to get on the tour bus, and they got on the tour bus, and they said, do you want some tea?
Well, they're not drinkers at all, Leppard, are they?
No, they were. Well, Steve Clark wasn't.
Steve was, of course.
He died. Yeah. So, Pete Willis was, and he left the band. Mm. Phil was, but then stopped. Mm.
So, just a rock and roll lifestyle to
me. And I was in the studio. I wasn't on tour. I was sitting there going, what was that?
Well, as I said before, I did that tour for 11 nights with them, and I was on the road with them all the time, and they were also always impeccably behaved, always, on stage, just probably one of the best rock bands I've ever seen in my life. You must have worked with some rock bands, Nicky.
I have. Yeah. But I was thinking of a story which is not really rock. It's, I suppose you'd call it pop, a Ross story. We were recording the second album. The first album I did in my studio in Parsons Green, the second album we did in a beautiful chateau in the south of France owned by Jacques Lussier, who used to play Bach on the piano. And he had this fantastic chateau with its own vineyard, and it was fabulous, great studio. And the Boss Boys were there. We decided to record there for the simple reason that we were far enough away from the fans, the Brossettes, that nobody would find out where we were. And of course, within a day of us being in this studio, there were Brossettes parked outside. There was a driveway that was about 2 miles long, and they were parked outside in their little Ford Fiestas. They'd driven down from England, and they were parked outside. And I thought, how the hell did you find out we were here? Oh, Matt phoned us and told us. So self-publicity. But that wasn't the story. The story was that after a while they were bored with, they had, Suzuki had given them three quad bikes and to play with, and these quad bikes were flown in from Japan and they're delivered to the studio, and they used to go off and drive around the vineyards and the estate on these quad bikes, and they got bored with that. They just bought, Luke had a Porsche 928 and Matt had a Mercedes convertible. They were driven out from some poor sod in England, in the management office, had to drive these cars out to the south of France. Matt was really excited he was going to go for a drive one night, and he didn't want to drive. I think he realised that James Dean died in a car crash when he was driving himself. So he asked the guitar player, Paul Gendler, to drive him. So off they went, and I thought, well, I'll probably never see them again, but anyway, because Paul wasn't a very good driver. And they went on to the autoroute. We were very close to the autoroute along the Riviera. And about 2 hours later, there was a huge kerfuffle, and a truck arrived with this Mercedes open-top sports car, wrecked, completely wrecked. And Paul had driven too fast, because Matt kept saying, drive faster, faster, go first. And he said, oh. And they hit some roadworks, and the car swung off the road. And they were all fine, but the car was a complete wreck, and they hid it in a barn so that the press wouldn't find out that Matt had very nearly killed himself in this beautiful Mercedes sports car, which was no longer, it was written off. So I don't know if that's a revelation or...
It's a story. That's the point.
I've not heard that story before.
Did you ever get found out? Was it released to the press? Did the press get press conference?
No, they hid the car away. It was covered in bales of hay, because there were photographers snooping around all the time. Bros madness was prevailing, and so the best thing to do was stick it in a barn, cover it in bales of hay, and lock the door so that nobody found out. I'll probably get sued now.
Yeah. Who's the most interesting person you've ever worked with, apart from the Pope? So.
Well, it's not really interesting, the Pope.
Well, I mean, I've worked with all kinds of people. I mean, I suppose the most interesting episode was that we're not working with Elton John, in a way, which led to me working with a number of other people for the same thing, which came about in a strange way, in that Elton had his record company, which was Rocket Records, and he, I think as a kind of birthday gift for his partner David Furnish, created Rocket Pictures as a sort of vehicle for doing movies and documentaries. David had directed documentaries in the past. They had this film which the title promises a lot more than it really ever delivered. It's called Women Talking Dirty. And they had all kinds of stars in it. Anyway, as it transpired, the director, who's a woman called Cokey Goodrich, she sounds like she should have been in the punk band. But anyway, so I had met her in a previous incarnation. I think it would be unkind to say she was a groupie, but she was certainly a girlfriend hanging around one of the bands I was producing for A&M Records at the time, who were this sort of glam threesome called... what are they called? I can't remember. The Mystery Girls. Oh, so I'd met her these years before. Anyway, she was going to direct this film. She was directing the film, and she asked if I would write the music, as I'd become a film composer in the interim. So I went down to Rocket Pictures and to meet with her and with David Furnish, and it was all agreed, yes, you're going to do it, blah, blah, blah. And they sorted out a deal. Blah, blah. Then about a week later, I got a phone call from David Furnish. And he said, Simon, Elton wants to talk to you, but this is a bit embarrassing, but the production company, they said, we can have another £5 million if it could possibly say music by Elton John. on the movie. Now, Elton's really embarrassed about it. He wanted to speak to you about it, but, you know, we wondered if it was at all possible that you could work with him, because he's not that, you know, confident with orchestras and writing film music, which I can tell you he's absolutely not confident doing that. So I, you know, I spoke to him about it, and I was genuinely very embarrassed, but I thought, well, you know, what can I really do? They're going to get all this more money to make the film. So I said yes, and actually I had really good time being flown around in helicopters and going to stay at this place in Nice and going to Windsor and a house in London, everything. So I had, it was quite good fun to do, but, and I have to say, having read certain pages of Elton's recent autobiography, he is a little less than truthful about this whole episode, where he talks about what a great fun it was to be a film composer. Now, basically, the situation was that I was supposed to do this with him, and they were going to say, they're going to put music by Elton John, produced and arranged by Simon Boswell. Okay, which I thought, well, everyone's going to see right through that anyway. So I would normally take 4-6 weeks, more than that, to write a film soundtrack. So I sit on, so what are we going to do? And he said, well, I can give you a day and a half in the studio. So he flew his sort of keyboard tech guy over from LA to, we were in the townhouse at Branson Studio, set up in there with his Sparky's toy piano, grand piano, which plays itself. He actually has this sort of MIDI piano which he can play, and then he can step away from it and the keys will go on their own, literally. It's extraordinary. But anyway, not so extraordinary these days, but it was back then. So I had been through the film, obviously, and I spent a day and a half with Elton in the studio at that point, saying to him, this is the first cue, really, you know, it's this. She's the lady. She's her husband's left her. She's feeling very sad. So it's kind of sad, sentimental theme. So he sat down at the piano. I'm sure you won't mind me saying this, but and played something that sounded a bit like "Candle in the Wind." I thought, well, that's, you know, it's a bit sad. It's a bit right. Like that. And then we move on to. I said then the pace picks up a bit. There's a bit, you know, this person gets chased down the street. "Candle in the Wind." So in the end, I still have them. I still have a CD of about 25 or 30 pieces which sound like "Candle in the Wind." Now my job was to take elements, bars, whatever, from this, turn it into a film score, orchestrate it for an orchestra, and that's what I did. And all the way through, I'm thinking to myself, well, they've got another 5 million quid, but if you put out a CD a Velton instrumental saying, if you enjoyed The Death of Princess Diana, you'll love this record, you know. That's marketing tech. And you make shitloads more money in this stupid fucking film. To be honest with you. Yeah, exactly. So, but anyway, it was good fun for me. And I just met, you know, as you can imagine, you meet everyone. It's like being in the court of French king. And there came points in it which were really good fun for me. Like there's a joke running through the film where the two characters who are the actress who's now in she's married to Tim Burton. Who's that?
Ellen
Bonham Carter, you know, and Gina, someone like that, Gina Miller, is it? Anyway, so they have a joke about Dolly Parton, and especially about the song Jolene, and they're in a pub in Glasgow, and they're always putting on that they adore Dolly Parton. There's this running joke through the film. So at a certain point, Elton said to me, he said, wouldn't it be just fun if for the end titles, because we've licensed Jolene, the original, for 2 or 3 times for the film, if you could do like a gay disco version of it. So I go, okay. You know, I mean, I'm up for doing anything. So I did this kind of quite high energy, almost a rave type version of it. And took the sample of her, just for Jolene, just to show what I could do with it. And I remember taking it down to Windsor, to Elton's place there. Elton likes to go and listen to things in his Rolls Royce. He can't drive. He sits in it and plays cassettes and CDs.
Seriously?
Seriously, yeah. So I remember sitting in his fucking Rolls Royce, playing this track. And he really, really liked it. Goes straight inside, phones up Dolly and says, can we do this? I'll send it over to you, blah, 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 you know. So we send it over to her. She really, really loves it. She's very game and up for anything. But she says, but I want to sing it again. Can you send Simon over to LA? So I get put on a plane. Yeah. And to go into a studio with Dolly, you know, just with the backing track. And there she's stood there on the mic and she sings it, you know, and she's an amazing singer. Let's face it, she's one of the most incredible singers. She sings it. And then she says, "Sam, what am I doing wrong?" You know, like, well, I honestly, nothing. But if you're asked that question, you must know what it's like. Those who have been a producer, you know, you're going to go, "Well, if you could try to..." So it's me trying to tell Dolly Parton how to sing Jolene. Which is just fucking ridiculous. But anyway, so we did it. We did it. I took it home. And then I get a call saying, "On the way back, could you stop off in New York and do a version of What a Wonderful World with Marianne Faithfull?" So I go to New York. How can I put this? It took 2 or 3 days to get Marianne in the studio at a point at which her nose wasn't so blocked. She must have had a terrible cold. Anyway, eventually we go into the studio and do a version there, which I then take over and do an orchestral version in London. So I had this amazing, I can't say it was a terrible time, because it wasn't, it was really good fun.
But it is interesting when you get an artist that you admire,
yeah,
and you are in some capacity working with them.
Yes.
And they ask your opinion.
Exactly.
As if you were on an equal plateau.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying, "What do you think? Could I do it better?" And you sort of sit there and think, are they really asking me that?
Yeah, well, it just shows you kind of how kind of random and how normal the most famous people are. I mean, they're not, you imagine that they're all kind of, you know, everything is all planned out and it's all like, but it's really, really not. And after that, Dolly liked this thing so much, she and I stayed in contact.
Like the way he holds his hands, Anita, talking about Dolly Parton.
Yeah. Oh, well, I can't. I could tell you that story too. That was an embarrassing moment too. But anyway, eventually she says, "I'm coming over to do the lottery show with Dale Winton, and I want to do it live. Could you come and do it with me?" So she says, "I'm coming to London. I'm doing the lottery show with Dale Winton. And I really like to do this new version of Jolene. Could you organise it?" So I said, "Well, yeah, okay, all right." So I, they put me in touch with the guy who was organising the other band who were playing that night, which was Boy George and Culture Club, and what sort of remained of Culture Club at this point. And the BBC said, "Do you mind if Culture Club is the backing band doing it?" So. And then Dolly said, "Can you play the banjo on it?" Because in fact, what I'd done is techno banjo. I play the guitar, but I can't play the banjo. It's actually a keyboard. And, you know, and I'd filtered it, so it's all like, you know, filtered dance music banjo. But she says, "Can you play the banjo with me?" So I say, "Yeah, sure, okay." So I do have the footage of this, of me miming to techno banjo, playing banjo, with like dancers all around. And Culture Club is a fucking band. It's like the weirdest fucking thing you've ever seen. Honestly, but, it was good fun. She then decided she wanted to do what Tom Jones did with Reload.
Mm.
She wanted to do collaborations with people, completely change, you know, not do country and western, not. And so we had a toing and froing on all this. I was going to get her to replace the Jerry after she left the Spice Girls. There was all stories about all this. Until someone very wise in Nashville said, you've got to alienate your entire fucking fan base into this. And so the idea rapidly went away. Thank God, actually, for her sake, you know. Anyway, there you go. That's my Dolly story.
So you're not even Catholic?
I'm not anything.
Right?
No. It was just, it's interesting because they actually don't care. Part of it could be if they ask the Catholic composer to write music, you know, for like the Pope's funeral stuff. I think they might be too intimidated to do. And I think there was something sensible about what they were doing by asking someone who was used to writing for movies to write something which perhaps was like, what I did was kind of respectful, but it was also perhaps a little bit more cinematic. You know what I mean? It was probably, you know, and you're well aware, you're working for a very well-oiled PR machine.
Did you meet a Pope, either of them? Did you meet either of them? Obviously one.
I never met John Paul II because he died in this whole interim of me starting work on this thing and not finishing that.
But you met the Nazi.
But I met the Nazi one, yes. Yes, I have a nice photo of me meeting him.
You must be a member of the PRS.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You didn't have to sign with the Italian version.
I did. And actually, there's another fantastic story attached.
End of part one.